You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A standout attraction during the holidays, for me at least, is food. And while there are many ways to enjoy this holiday eating season, perhaps we should also use the time of the year to think about the forces behind how and what we eat. Here to do that, and maybe even provide a few helpful holiday cooking tips, is Mark Bittman. His writing appears regularly in the New York Times, and he's the author of over a dozen cookbooks, including the classic How to Cook Everything. His most recent is How to Cook Everything, The Basics, All You Need to Make Great Food. It's published by Wiley and includes 1,000 recipes, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Great to be here, Lenny.
There are many ideologies around the best way to eat now, whether it's sustained or local or organic, plus a number of other pressing social, environmental, and political issues. How much concern do you think that we should give to those issues when we're cooking for the holidays? Isn't this a stressful enough time?
Well, it is a funny question. I don't know. It shouldn't be that stressful a time. I suppose if people are stressed out, then that's something to worry about. I think sustainability, which comprises all the other things you mentioned and more, is an important long-run issue. And you know, if you don't think about it for the next 3 weeks, who cares? But in the long run, it really matters.
Well, it's a little harder right now because much of the local food that people who choose to eat that way were getting from green markets, many of which have closed down for the winter. Most of the vegetables we're getting, other than the root vegetables, are coming from somewhere else, aren't they?
Well, that's if you choose to make local eating a priority, that's what you're going to have to do. Or join a frozen food CSA, which is a possibility too.
Are frozen food CSAs?
There are CSAs that do frozen foods in the winter, yeah. But you know, if you live in the Northeast, you're never going to be able to be a strict locavore unless you're eating a lot of frozen food and a lot of root vegetables. I think sustainability is not about locavorism, but about some kind of regionality and about thinking the big picture.
The food industry seems to have discovered words like organic and natural as marketing tools, but have sustainable farming practices really been adopted as part of the industrial food production in any meaningful way?
I think the short answer to that is no. But I do think that industrial food production shows signs of moving in the right direction, and that at least there are individuals on the big scale who are trying to do things better. I think we're going to see more of that. Having said that, it's certainly true that long ago the word natural was co-opted and organic has pretty much been perverted also. So it's difficult, but it's early days in a way. And you know, it's like any other. We're looking at a great deal of change that's necessary. So if you think about, you know, the women's rights movement or the Voting Act or things like that, you have to look at the long haul for these kinds of changes. It's not going to happen in, 2014.
Some people see a bit of irony in the fact that when you buy organic milk, it's often ultra-pasteurized, which seems to go against the whole idea of something that's natural.
I think there are many different ways of – this is a quite complicated topic. There are many different ways of looking at what the ideal food is. The good thing about organic – I think we can say the good thing about organic is that it defines that chemical pesticides cannot be used on the food, which is certainly good for farm workers if for no one else. But it also means there are going to be fewer pesticide residues in that food for all of us. And also it means that, animals raised organically are going to have to be eating organic food and have to be spending some time outside. All of these things are important. Doesn't mean it's being done perfectly. It just means it's better.
Didn't you recently travel to California's Central Valley, which is one of the world's most productive agricultural regions? What kinds of things are being grown there?
I did. I traveled there right around Labor Day, and it probably is the most productive region in the world.
Has it been hit by the drought this year?
It wasn't hit nearly as badly as the Midwest, and in part that's because it's not what's unusual about Central Valley is that it is industrial. Big-time agriculture happens there, but it's also there are, say, 50 major crops in the Central Valley. It's not like the Midwest where there are two or three major crops. There's a lot of different stuff being grown. So you can see, you know, everything from pistachios to walnuts to carrots to broccoli to tomatoes. You know, it's the biggest producer of canned tomatoes in the world and so on.
But still in a kind of a monocultural way in many cases. Like if they're growing almonds, you just go for miles and miles of seeing just almond trees.
Absolutely. There's not a lot of crop rotation, but at least there's diversity so that the whole area isn't going to be, you know, slammed at the same time by one weather event.
Anyone who's driven down Interstate 5 in California has experienced the overwhelming smell of cow manure as they approach the town of Coalinga and the gigantic feedlot there. Is that fairly typical for California agriculture?
Harris Feedlot, it's also called Cowschwitz. Well, that's the it's amazing that you bring it up because no one fails to, and everybody who's driven down
I-5 has seen it. It's like driving down past Elizabeth in New Jersey and saying, well, those chemical plants sure smell bad.
Right. There are amazing mega dairies. Harris Feedlot is not a mega dairy, but the mega dairies in Coalinga and nearby Hanford, I think I have that right, are there's just one after the other. And these are dairies with thousands, not hundreds, but thousands of cows.
Well, doesn't cow manure make a good natural fertilizer? Is that the way most of it's disposed of?
No. It does. I mean, yes, it does make good natural fertilizer, but you need it in a quantity you can handle. And when you have 50,000 cows, it's just an overwhelming amount. So then the worry is, how in God's name are we going to get rid of all this? We're certainly not spreading it on nearby pastures because it would kill everything.
It would kill everything?
Well, you can't. You know, you can only use so much manure. It has to be composted before you use it. Before it's composted, it's too hot to use. So you can't just start dumping manure on land. It destroys the land, which is what happens.
And anyway, you do it, a lot of methane gas is released. Is that a dangerous situation in an area like that?
It's unpleasant. In the long run, you know, you're seeing dairies all over the country that are using manure to generate energy, and you're seeing methane energy plants, and you're seeing compost that's being used to generate energy as well as compost. So there are ways to do this. There are sustainable and there are recyclable, renewable ways to do this, but it's very hard to do it on a really, really big scale.
Did you find that most of the companies, because this is where there are huge agribusinesses that were growing food, they were treating the land responsibly?
It may be overly optimistic and even naive of me, but I'd say increasingly yes. But are they treating it well? No. Are they treating it better? I would say yes. Are things moving in the right direction? I would say yes.
Well, according to the EPA, about 5 billion pounds of pesticides are used in the United States each year. I would assume that a lot of it is being used in California.
Yeah, although I would assume that a lot more of it is being used in the Midwest. You know, where the monoculture culture is really big time. You know, where you see
corn and soy,
2,000, 3,000, 4,000 acres of one crop at the same time. You know, I wrote about pesticides this week in the Times, and I think there were a number of horrifying things about that story. I think the most horrifying thing was that something like 98% of the pesticides that are applied don't reach their target. So you're spraying pesticides for your corn, and 2% of the pesticides you're spraying actually hit the corn. The rest goes everywhere else but the corn, which means, of course, you have to use more in order to get the amount on the corn you want to. But this phenomenon of pesticide drift means that almost all of the pesticides that are sprayed wind up somewhere else. Some of them wind up in our. I mean, another horrifying fact of this piece is that there doesn't appear to be a person in the United States who doesn't have some pesticide residue in their body fat. So that's pretty creepy.
My guest is Mark Bittman. His latest book, How to Cook Everything, the Basics All You Need to Make Great Food with 1,000 Photos. The book is published by Wiley.
Are we making a U-turn here?
No, I'm just telling people who you are, and we'll talk about that as well. But I thought this was really important, and you've been an important spokesperson in this area, and people are concerned about whether their food is healthy, but also whether the environment is being damaged, especially now when more people are accepting the concept of climate change, which can be related, especially with all that methane. And you suggest that the pesticide, there's a lot of pesticide drip. If in the past, if you'd walked through fields, you would have found a lot of different insects, little animals running around as well, some of them probably not the farmer's friends. But is there any wildlife at all in these fields these days?
I can't answer that question definitively, but I would say given that the fields are routinely poisoned, they're certainly not as much as there should be.
So that means that we're killing the bees and the ladybugs.
Yeah, a lot of people do associate this bee die-off with contemporary agriculture, problems with contemporary agriculture. Yeah, ladybug. Or you can't kill only the non-beneficial. You can't kill only the harmful insects. And also, you can't even define what's harmful for one crop may be beneficial for another crop. So this is why, every bit of responsible research that you read says if you rotate crops, if you do integrated pest management, you do these kinds of things, you can reduce the number of pests, you can have biological controls, you can have literally natural controls like insects feeding on other insects that happen to be damaging, and so on down the line.
But you also mentioned farm workers, and they're working in this pesticide-infected area.
Yeah, I think the news the situation for farm workers is not good. And whenever anyone speaks ill or says, well, organic food isn't that important or it's not that effective, they are forgetting about the farm workers for whom it is really important. And pesticide controls, the primary concerns about pesticide controls are farm workers and land. We citizens are secondary, but, again, as I wrote yesterday, everyone is being affected by pesticides in their food, including kids, and pesticides are being implicated in lower IQs and hyperactivity and so on down the line. It's not funny.
Farm workers are also subject to other problems, wage theft. They have a tough life, and they work often many hours, and their kids are often working with them, and they seem to be invisible. I guess because we don't want to pay a lot more money for the things that they bring to our tables.
Well, and of course we pay, maybe not of course. I mean, some things that may seem self-evident to you or to me are not to everyone, and the fact that you're raising the farm worker issue, I don't think 3 years ago, either of us would have been sitting. I mean, I know that 3 years ago, you and I weren't sitting here talking about farm workers. So something has happened to make us more conscious of that, which is a good thing. You raise the issue of cost of food, and we Americans spend something between 7 and 9%, so let's call it 8% of our income on food, the lowest of any industrialized nation. We spend less money on food than anyone else in the world. Food is cheaper here, and we spend less on it. So do you want sustainable food? Do you want farm workers to be treated better? Do you want animals to be treated better? It's going to cost. There's no question. And it's going to cost one way or the other because though food is cheap now, we're forestalling a lot of these costs.
You mentioned research. What did you make of the research that was published a couple of months back that suggested that this kind of farming is no worse for us in terms of nutrition and taste and everything than organically raised produce?
Well, this is the notorious Stanford study, which was roundly criticized by almost everybody. But if it found it, it's not even clear that it really found that organic food was not more nutritious than conventionally grown food. But that's not – people don't buy organic food because they think it's more nutritious. They buy it because they think it's safer, and it's unquestionably safer. And it probably tastes better. And – in the long run, it's going to be found to be somewhat more nutritious also.
Is it covered at all in the Farm Bill, which seems to be stalled in Congress?
Yeah, it is covered in the Farm Bill. But, the Farm Bill is so impossible to understand that I just as soon move on to the next question.
Well, we're going to take a little break, and you can think about it for a while. But we'll talk also about cooking for the holidays and the series of books that you've done on cooking everything. The most recent is How to Cook Everything, The Basics, All You Need to Make Great Food. It is published by Wiley. We will continue this conversation with Mark Bittman right after this. We're back with Mark Bittman. His latest book is How to Cook Everything, The Basics, All You Need to Make Great Food. It is published by Wiley. We've been talking about farming, and you have tried to balance your role as a food writer with and giving recipes and trying to make us think about how to rethink making the foods that we make with concerns about ethical food producing. The two have to be tied together, or is Paula Deen also a worthwhile part of this equation?
Well, without addressing the last part of that question directly, in my mind, they have to be tied together. There was a time 20 years ago that I, in good conscience, could think about cooking and eating and restaurants and everything else with little besides, let's say, joy, with little reservation. But now it seems you can hardly have a conversation about food without talking about ethics and sustainability. It just doesn't feel right any longer. We know too much, and things have gotten too bad.
And have we finally stopped hearing you're being an elitist when you talk this way?
I don't think it's elite. I don't think it's elitist to talk about the sustainability of agriculture, the sustainability of the planet, the sustainability of our health.
What will you be making during the holiday season? Will you be stressing vegetables? Because you have announced that you are a semi-vegetarian. You're a vegetarian up until 6 o'clock.
Vegan before 6, usually, yeah. I'll be eating that way. I don't know what I'll be – I never know what I'm going to be cooking. I go to the store and I buy what looks good, basically, and then I go home and cook it. And I don't have any plans, and I think that I'm going to be pretty much alone with my wife for the 10 days around Christmas. So I think it'll be very, very simple stuff.
When you shop, do you look at labels?
I do look at labels, but I'd say that 80% of the food that I buy doesn't have a label. I mean, it's vegetables or fish or chicken or meat or whatever.
Were you surprised that Prop 37, the California proposition that would have required labeling of GMOs, failed in the ballot box?
Well, I would have been surprised had there not been polls that showed that it was going to lose. It was very, very tight. The amazing thing is that when I went out, we were talking about my trip to the Central Valley. When I went on that trip, which was, as I said, around Labor Day, late August, early September, Prop 37 had a 40-point lead. That is that 40% more people were saying yes, voting yes, than voting no. And then the anti-Prop 37 forces spent about $45 million. So about $1 million will buy you a percentage point in a referendum in California, evidently. They also outspent the pro-Prop 37 people by about 10 to 1. I'd like to know who'd be president if we'd let Romney outspend Obama by 10 to 1.
But it has not been proven that GMO produce is
damaging
in any way.
Damaging to the environment. I mean, GMOs, we talked about pesticides and genetically engineered foods have been directly responsible for an increase in the use of pesticides, and it was supposed to be the other way around. So it's damaging in that sense. Does it hurt you more to eat Frosted Flakes made with GMO corn than it does to eat Frosted Flakes made without GMO corn? I think the answer to that is probably no. But GMOs are damaging in other ways. But that wasn't the main issue about Prop 37 was transparency and telling people what they need to know about what's in their food. So GMOs is one thing, but antibiotic residue, pesticide residue, these are other things. How food is grown in terms of how are animals treated, how are labor treated, those are things that people might like to know.
Now, you just mentioned that we actually wind up using more pesticides in growing GMO crops. In fact, in a recent column, you noted in General Fields, growing crops using genetically engineered seeds use 24% more chemicals than those grown with conventional seeds. Weren't GMOs supposed to reduce our dependency on pesticides?
And they did at first, and then what happened was weeds, as they are wont to do, because weeds are very smart, developed resistance to the very pesticides that were being sprayed on them. So there was this new generation of what are called super weeds, just like there's a new generation of things called super bugs, which are antibiotic resistant. And the super weeds require more pesticides to kill them. They also require – sometimes people have to go into the fields with machetes to chop down these weeds.
Now, I know we've talked about this before, but do you think that it's better to buy something that's labeled organic if it was grown in China or in Chile as opposed to something – that was grown locally?
I think it's individual choice. I think it's a case-by-case choice. I think, you know, if I were offered frozen, sliced, organic red peppers from China, I could conceive of buying them as opposed to fresh, non-organic peppers from California. It's so tricky. I mean, there's no simple answer to that question.
Hal, one of our listeners, left a comment on our show page asking, I'm quoting, "I understand frozen vegetables have retained more nutrients than even vegetables that have been picked days ago. What are the trade-offs when you're considering frozen vegetables?"
One of the funnest pieces I ever wrote in the Times a few years ago in defense of frozen vegetables. And there is an argument that they're grown and harvested at the peak, and frozen soon thereafter, so that maybe sometimes they have greater nutrients. Certainly some of them are lost in the freezing process, but I think they're a good option. I think, you know, I know I sound like I'm hedging on all these answers. I don't think any of them are clear in that the better informed you are, the more you can sort of go to the store with some kind of arsenal of knowledge and make decent decisions. No single decision is going to kill or cure you, of course.
Sometimes you have no choice. I wanted pearl onions for Thanksgiving. And none of the stores I went to had them. They said they had all ordered them, but the warehouse hadn't sent them in. I guess there was a pearl onion shortage this year.
Well,
so I used frozen pearl onions, and you wouldn't have known the difference.
No, you wouldn't. Thanksgiving was weird this year anyway because it was only 3 weeks after Sandy. And, you know, I was shopping yesterday, and guys were saying, we're still backed up. We still don't have the inventory we'd like to have. So shipping is still being affected by that.
My guest is Mark Bittman, writes for the New York Times and also has written a series of very popular cookbooks, including the How to Cook Everything series, most recent one called The Basics. What did you – oh, this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What do you mean by The Basics? I thought all of these were pretty much The Basics.
Well, you know, when How to Cook Everything, the big one, first came out, people did say to me – there were a percentage of people who said to me, I don't want to know how to cook everything. I want to know how to cook something. So this sort of addresses that. And it's a book – it's not a small book, but it has fewer recipes with, I don't know, like 1,000 photographs. So it's really a step-by-step book for beginners.
A way of teaching people technique? Because you've done videos.
Technique, but also, you know, here are a couple hundred really, really popular recipes and how to make them, every step illustrated. It's not technique-y the way Jacques Pepin's technique books are technique-y, because I'm not that technique-y a guy. You know, my technique is not that great. I just try to get decent food on the table.
You have called sugar the tobacco of the 21st century. Do you believe the health dangers of sugar have been suppressed in the way that the risk of cigarettes were for such a long time?
Yeah, I do, and I think we're going to find that out. And I think 50 years from now, we are going to be saying sugar was the tobacco of the 21st century.
So when I look at a label and it says corn fructose or sugar or whatever as the first or second ingredient in a product, that should set off alarm bells?
I think, you know, unless you're looking for dessert, I think it's a product you probably don't want to buy. And most often, if sugar is the first ingredient, then the third ingredient is going to be maltodextrose, and the fifth ingredient is going to be high fructose corn syrup, and the seventh ingredient is going to be sucrose, and so on down the line. And you find that, lo and behold, of these 30 ingredients, which is a dead giveaway anyway, you don't really want to buy stuff with 30 ingredients, five of them are sugars, or seven are sugars.
And yet the public's response to Mayor Bloomberg's call for a large soda ban is similar to what happened in California with Prop 37.
But the public's response to the non-smoking laws was also hostile at first, and now everybody's used to them and happy about them. The public didn't want to be forced to wear seatbelts, and now everybody wears seatbelts routinely, and indeed it's decreased deaths in automobile accidents.
And yet two towns in California, Richmond and El Monte, both had soda taxes on the ballot this past election, and both of them failed.
Well, again, they were outspent in one case, I think 75-1, the pro-tax forces versus the pro-soda forces. I think, as I said, you know, early on in this interview, I think these things are going to take time, and there's good reason to be disheartened by any event that goes the wrong way. But in the long run, we're going to see positive change. We have to.
A caller wants to donate to soup kitchens, but he worries about donating canned food that may be full of unhealthy ingredients. How do you think he should proceed?
Maybe we should get the ethicist in here. Well, I suppose if you're giving the canned food away because you're afraid to eat it yourself, maybe you're better off tossing it. But in general, I think soup kitchens are probably glad to get whatever they can get.
What about somebody else suggests, are we going to see an Occupy Farm movement somewhere down the line?
We will see increasing movement in the world of food. I don't know if it'll be called Occupy Farms, but yeah.
In the foreword of How to Cook Everything, you write, my goal here is to make the case for the numerous and wonderful benefits of cooking to make you want to cook. Do you think that people aren't cooking as much as they should these days?
Well, we know that people are cooking less than they should, and we know that it's a skill. I believe that it's a skill that skills, craft, whatever, that can help you live a better life. So I would not say that all old crafts are worth learning. I'm not sure it's important for us to know how to sew or make candles, but I do think it's important for us to know how to cook. And we do eat better. Everything points to the fact that we eat better when we cook.
So why do you think people aren't? Just because there are so many other options, prepared foods in stores, and of course all of the fast food stores around the country?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. I mean, we've been taught to uncook, and it's it's complicated. It starts with the post-World War II move toward marketing so-called convenience, and it continues with women's entry into the workforce, the fact that cooking was stigmatized so that it was an unmanly thing to do, and so on down the line. All of this has to be countered. Not women working doesn't have to be countered, but all of this has to be taken into account and say, okay, despite the fact that, you know, the household looks much different than it did when you and I were young, and we can remember that, how do we get people to cook?
What surprises me is when I go to some mid-sized cities and I see so few local restaurants. Pretty much everything is part of a chain.
Yeah.
And you wonder why people support that trend rather than somebody who might very well be making very nice, wholesome food.
The short answer to that is marketing. The power of Applebee's, McDonald's, and so on to convince you that this is food it's easy, it's going to make you happy when you eat it, it's not going to cost a lot of money, and this is very compelling marketing.
So do you think that the way to change food culture in the United States will require changing other aspects of our culture?
I think that to have a democratic food system, we need a real democracy, and that if we can build a democratic food system, we will be helping build a real democracy. It's not a small issue. It really affects almost every— I mean, certainly it affects agriculture, affects energy use, it affects health care. Those are three really, really big issues that we have to deal with all the time. So if you're working towards a sustainable and just food system, you're working toward really big changes in agriculture. You're going to see huge implications in healthcare, huge implications in energy use, and so on.
Isn't it ironic that the places we often point to as having had a better approach, Europe especially, now seem to be moving in the U.S. direction?
Well, what you can hope is that they see— this is often the case. It's fun when you go to Europe and they say, oh, you poor Americans, you have McDonald's on every corner, and then you go back 10 years later and there's McDonald's on every corner. But one can hope that the Europeans and people all over the world, I mean, because fast food is making incredible advances in India and China, and because Mexico, for example, is now second in the world in obesity after the United States, you can only hope that these people look at the United States and say, maybe we've gone far enough down this road and we can turn around now.
Well, the slow movement started in reaction to American fast food companies.
And it started in Italy. But, you know, Italy, there's a lot of fast food in Italy now. But, you know, you can only hope that people say, clearly our traditions are better than moving in this direction, preferable to moving in this direction.
Mark Bittman writes for the New York Times opinion section as well as for the New York Times magazine. He used to write the minimalist column for 13 years. We miss it. But that attitude still shows up in his many cookbooks. He's written over a dozen cookbooks, including the best-selling How to Cook Everything, How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. And you can also get them as apps.
The apps are great. The apps for iPhone for vegetarian and the original How to Cook Everything are really, really good.
And now the most recent is How to Cook Everything, the basics, all you need to make great food. Can I consult this for holiday cooking, or is this more for everyday use?
You might be – yes, you can consult it for holiday cooking, but you personally may be a little too advanced for the basics. I think you're better off cooking from How to Cook Everything, the original How to Cook Everything. This is
you're
for,
too kind. Boy.
Yeah, well, I know you can cook, so –
The book is published by Wiley, has lots of pictures. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me, Lenny.